In 1955, the men who lynched Chicagoan Emmett Till were found not guilty. Here's Till's mother and footage from a documentary.
Well, the whole trial was just a farce, but the verdict was the one that I had expected to be given.
Now the DOJ has reopened the case, partially due to new evidence from a book by historian Timothy Tyson. We'll speak with Tyson about what he learns and what he expects out of the new investigation. Plus, last Thursday, President Trump visited Illinois for the first time since taking office. Here he is speaking to steelworkers in Granite City.
Workers are back on the job, and we are once again pouring new American steel into the spine of our country.
We'll unpack that visit and its ripple effect on Illinois politics. And a new study reveals that when women earn more than their husbands, both are so uncomfortable that they lie about it. We're talking about money and relationships later this hour on the 21st. Stay tuned. Welcome to the 21st. I'm Nyla Boodoo. Later in the hour, we're going to be talking about marriages and money, plus what President Trump's visit to Illinois last week means for local politicians who are aligning with them. But first this hour, the FBI has reopened the case into the killing of Emmett Till, a 14-year-old black Chicagoan who was tortured to death in 1955 in Mississippi after an encounter he had in a store with a white woman named Carolyn Bryant. Many of us learned about Till in school and remember those disturbing photos of his open casket. The actions of his mother, Mamie Till Mobley, to choose to have that open casket and the subsequent publishing of those photos became a defining moment in American history. And while those images and his story continue to haunt us, as it turns out, there are still many questions about his death some six decades later. An all-white jury found Carolyn Bryant's husband and brother-in-law not guilty of the murder. But months after that not guilty verdict, the pair confessed to beating, killing, and throwing Emmett Till into a river to Look magazine because it paid them $3,500 for their story. In another confession just last year, Carolyn Bryant told historian Timothy Tyson, quote, "Nothing that boy did could ever justify what happened to him." Timothy Tyson is on the line with me now. He's the author of The Blood of Emmett Till. He's also a senior research scholar at Duke University and an adjunct professor of American Studies at the University of North Carolina. Hi, Timothy. Welcome to the 21st. Thanks for being here.
Oh, glad to be here. Thank you so much.
I wanted to start by asking you about that conversation with Carolyn Bryant, because she didn't speak publicly about the events of 1955 after the trial until you spoke with her. And I don't think it's maybe surprising for a lot of people to find out that she said what she testified to in court wasn't true. But what did she say to you about what happened?
She said, first she sort of muttered, well, they're all dead now anyway. And then she said and in referring to
her husband, I imagine. Is that who she was talking about?
She said referring to her testimony on the stand, which, you know, was tantamount to a rape attempt, you know, a physical assault of a sexual sort. She said that part's not true. She said, I asked her what did happen. And she said, to be honest, I'd like to tell you, but I don't really remember. You tell these stories over and over again until they seem true, but that part's not true. Nothing that boy did could ever justify what happened to him. So that's the piece of it that's people have focused on. I really think it's not really wasn't really news to me. I'd never thought she was telling the truth, and I don't know anybody else that did. Also, I'd seen the notes of her conversation with her attorney. The attorney took clear notes, and they said that he took down her story. This was about 5 days after the murder, and she said he had, quote, insulted, unquote, her. That was the verb that was used. It was a plus. The evidence is pretty clear because the men who showed up at Reverend and Mrs. Wright's house, his great aunt and great uncle, and kidnapped him at Till, barged in with pistols in the middle of the night, and said, "We've come for the one that done the talking up at Money." And all the things they said during that, there were seven witnesses, all the things they said during that kidnapping referred to talk, smart talking, that sort of thing. And no mention of anybody putting hands on anybody. And if you think those men, had they thought that Emmett Till had put his hands on Carolyn Bryant, they would not have mentioned talking, you know. So I thought that was fairly strong evidence that she had been lying. So I wasn't very surprised at that.
And when we think about,
newsworthy.
When we think about the case, how much I wonder, I'm curious how much you think this admission in your book that came out last year had to do with the Department of Justice now reopening the case.
Well, they've had my materials for a year and a half. And, I think the timing is is odd. When you've got when Jeff Sessions and Donald Trump have brown children in cages along the border, and Donald Trump doesn't seem to be able to make a moral distinction between Nazis and people who protest them peacefully, when they're both engaged in a relentless attack on voting rights, particularly among minority voters, I just think, this is a charade, honestly.
Mm. We're speaking with author and historian Timothy Tyson. His book is called The Blood of Emmett Till. And before we continue, I wondered if we could play a little bit, hear a little bit from Emmett Till's mother speaking after his death in 1955. This is from a documentary called The Untold Story of Emmett Till.
It's my opinion that the guilt begins with Mrs. Bryant. And I want to see Mrs. Bryant punished, her husband, and any other persons that were in on this thing. And I feel like the pressure should start from the President of the United States and be channeled all the way down to the township of Money, Mississippi. And I'm certainly of the opinion that inasmuch as my son had to die, that I don't want his death to be a vain thing. If it can further the cause of freedom, then I will say that he died a hero.
That's Mamie Till Mobley in a documentary called The Untold Story of Emmett Till. My guest is Timothy Tyson. He's the author of The Blood of Emmett Till, and we're talking about how the FBI has just reopened this case from 1955. And as she says that, as I'm listening to her speak, Tim, I wanted to ask you, you make an interesting point in your book about who was complicit in Emmett's death. And you make the case that it's not just the people who actually did it, but the broader society at the time, including the president at the time. Can you explain a little bit more about why you said that?
Sure. For example, President Eisenhower, in responding to the Brown versus Board of Education decision that struck down school segregation, said all they're worried about is they don't want their sweet little girl sitting next to some big Negro on the bus. That, he could have provided moral leadership and chose not to do so. The federal government would not intervene in the case. They have had, nor did they intervene in the many assassinations in Mississippi of voting rights activists, which obviously, those assassinations violated the 14th and 15th Amendment. So it was a federal crime, but they, J. Edgar Hoover was a committed white supremacist, and basically the country didn't care. Also, you have to understand that Chicago is very important in this story. Black Chicago was in a struggle, a daily ongoing struggle against segregation. There were whole dozens and dozens of unsolved bombings of black homes where white residents believed they had moved over a line into a white neighborhood. There was a virtual race war going on in a housing development called Trumbull Park, which was only about 5 miles from where Emmett Till lived. He played baseball all the time, and the idea is sort of put forward that he didn't know about race and segregation because he was – a little boy from Chicago, but Chicago was more segregated than Mississippi. And if you didn't know where you could not play baseball, you would be in trouble. But Chicago was a city of ethnic neighborhoods, and outsiders were in danger, and black children were the most visible outsiders. So, Chicago was in a racial struggle every bit as much as Mississippi was.
And do you think I wonder, with the hindsight now we have of the past 60 years, how important was the role of Mamie, his mother, in all of this, in terms of how much this became seared into our national consciousness?
Pivotal. And she's often spoken of as courageous, which she was. But the truth is, the thing that mattered most was her political savvy, her judgment, and the way she read the political situation, and the way she was able to leverage black Chicago, by which I mean, 60 years of community organizing in Chicago, the Chicago Defender, the Johnson Publishing Company, which was, Jet and Ebony and half a dozen other magazines, the Brotherhood of Sleeping Car Porters, the United Packing House Workers, the strongest black political machine in the world, the Dawson machine, which had actually installed Mayor Daley, the NAACP. So these are community institutions, but they're also national institutions. And so using those, she and her allies were able to launch a movement from coast to coast, hundreds and hundreds of thousands of people, not only protesting against the injustice and the brutality of this case, but also building a national infrastructure that made the civil rights movement's emergence possible, and raising lots of money. They funded the Montgomery bus boycott in part. So
right, and Rosa Parks said, in fact, right, she said
very,
she
very
thought about him,
thing.
Right? I remember Rosa Parks saying thought about the pictures when she decided to not give up her seat on the bus.
Yes, Dr. T.R.M. Howard, who was a grassroots activist from the Mississippi Delta, who investigated the Till case, he spoke at the Dexter Street Baptist Church in Montgomery in October late November of 1955. And for Rosa Parks heard him speak. They sat up all night talking movement politics. 4 days later, she was arrested on that bus and later said, "I thought about Emmett Till and I could not move."
When we think about Emmett Till's family, I wonder what you're hoping for now that this is the second time, actually, the FBI has reopened the case, because I know it was reopened in 2004. They spent 2 years investigating that, including exhuming his body in Chicago. Now, what are you hoping for? Are you hopeful that we will see something happen with this case?
Well, I fully supported the investigation from the day the FBI called me, and I quickly sent in them and the Justice Department all my research materials. But the FBI has really never, given up on this case since 1955. And in 2004, they reopened it formally again at the behest of the Till family, and it was open for 2 years. And in that 2 years, they collected 8,000 pages of evidence. They found the full transcript of the trial, which had been disappeared since 1955. They made a 135-page report on the case, on what we know about the case. It's very good. And they were, they've concluded that they were not able to, that they had not found anything that would justify a prosecution. So they gave that information over to the district attorney in LaFleur County, Mississippi, which is, where Emmett Till was killed, and a 19-member grand jury, pretty close to half black and half white, voted 19-0 not to indict Carolyn Bryant, seeing no evidence of anything prosecutable. What she confessed to me was perjury.
Lying on the stand.
Right, and that was the statute of limitations on perjury is 2 years. So she'd been clear on that for a long, long time.
Tim, I just wanted to end. We just have a few minutes left here, but you wrote something in your book that stood out to me. You said that America is still killing Emmett Till. And when we think about Emmett Till, his name is one of many, Michael Brown, Tamir Rice, Trayvon Martin, Laquan McDonald. I could go on.
But yes, I know.
Given that the list of young black men who have been murdered, the list continues to grow. Does that change the context of how we talk about Emmett Till?
Well, I think Emmett Till's story has gripped us for decades now, for basically three reasons. One, the horror of it reminds us, consciously or unconsciously, of the enormous death machine of the Atlantic slave trade, in whose moral abyss this nation was born. Also, because Emmett's story speaks to the ongoing crisis of race and democracy in America, which has been, been ongoing since 1955. So the case has continued to be a symbol of America's racial injustice, the vast inequality and police violence, and without legal recourse for the most part, and this ruthless indifference to African American children. And then also because I think Mamie Till Mobley and Black Chicago, her allies there and across the country, the way they rose up to protest his death and to push the system over, of which his lynching is really an inevitable product, and he was far from the first lynching victim, even the first child lynching victim in Mississippi, and there were thousands and thousands across the region. So it wasn't really just a crucifixion of this small black child, if you will, but a resurrection of our best hopes and aspirations for America. So I think in that way, this story continues to be relevant, and I think it will continue to be relevant. I hope that the FBI has found, evidence that triangulates with what I found in some way that will help illuminate.
Yeah.
I'm
afraid
I suspect not.
Yeah. Thank you for that, Tim. Timothy Tyson's the author of The Blood of Emmett Till, talking to us about the FBI reopening the case. Thank you for taking the time. I appreciate it.
Oh, thank you so much for having me. Bye-bye.
Welcome back to The 21st. I'm Nyla Boodoo. As we mentioned earlier in the hour, we want to spend a little time today talking about money, specifically relationships and money. In fact, think about the last time you got into an argument about money with your partner. If only I could hear nodding over the radio. This is also an issue that makes lots of people squirm. Let's take salaries. According to a new paper from the Census Bureau, when women earn more than their husbands, both of them may be so uncomfortable with it that they lie to the government. This is still a relatively small group, women who are the top earners in their families, but it's a growing one. So we wanted to talk to you about how you navigate these dynamics at home. We've been asking you about this on social media. Lisa from Evanston told us on Facebook, "I make more than my husband, and we both are very comfortable about it. He actually even brags about it. Now, it's a private matter. We don't necessarily shout it from the rooftops, but both of our families know that I make more money, and I don't think we've ever lied about it in any form." What about you? Are you a woman who earns more than your partner? Are you a man who earns less? Are you in a same-sex relationship where the financial dynamics are totally unique? We'd love to hear from you. Our phone number is 1-800-222-9455. That's 1-800-222-9455. We're also on Twitter at 21STShow, and we've got some tweets already this morning that I will read to you in a little bit. But joining me now to talk about this is Professor Tamara Goldman-Schur. She's a PhD clinical psychologist who practices at the Family Institute at Northwestern University, where she's actually speaking to us from our studios at the Medill School of Journalism in Evanston. Annie Logue is also on the line with us. She's the author of a number of books in the Four Dummies series about finances and investing. She's also a lecturer at UIC. Professor Schur and Annie, both of you, welcome to the 21st. Thanks for being with me.
Thanks for having me. Happy
to
be here.
Thank you so much.
Annie, let's start with you, because when we look at the numbers, it shows that this is an increasing number of women who are earning more than men. It's about there's about a quarter of American couples, since this is up about 20% mm-hmm. since the 1980s. What do we know about the impact that's had on marriages?
Well, we know that this is a big cultural change. Historically, Marriages have been marked by what we call hypergamy or hypogamy in demographic circles. So hypergamy is marrying up and hypogamy is marrying down. And historically, women tend to marry up in terms of economics and social class, and men tend to marry down. And historically, marrying, simply a woman marrying a man, was marrying up because men had so much more access to money and legal rights that women did not have. So this is the evolution of a trend that starts with marriage for love. And it's something that has been exacerbated in recent years because people are marrying, are more likely to be marrying equals. So the example that's often given is that at one time, the lawyer may have married the legal secretary. Now a lawyer is marrying another lawyer. Or you even start getting more extreme cases where the lawyer is marrying the hedge fund manager. These are people who are traveling in similar educational and social circles, and their income capability is much higher than average, and in some cases, extremely higher than average. At the same time...
Annie, is this something that occurs across all income levels? Because you've been... The examples that we've been talking about so far have been more on the higher end of the income scale.
It is absolutely happening at all ends of the income scale, because at the lower end, because of increasing income equality and better rights for women in the workplace, the gap between what women earned and what men earned is narrowing. And to some extent, it is narrowing fastest at the lower end of the workplace because wages are more likely to be standardized. There's less room for negotiation. The other thing that has happened at the lower end of the market is that benefits are going away with jobs. And so the advantages for a woman to marrying a man are getting a lot smaller, the economic advantages, to be specific. And so what we're seeing is a rapid decline in marriage rates among people with lower income levels. And increasingly, the woman is more likely to have a job that is at least as good or better than the man if she does choose to get married.
That's Annie Logue. She's the author of a couple of books in the For Dummies series about financing and investing, and also a business and finance lecturer at University of Illinois, Chicago. Tamara Goldman-Schur is with us as well. She practices clinical psychology at the Family Institute at Northwestern University. And Tamara, I wanted to ask you, when you're looking at relationship dynamics, what do you think the issues are at play here? And I'm thinking initially of what this census paper highlighted, that when a woman made more than her partner, neither of those disclosed that. And now I'm not necessarily talking about the legal implications. I'm curious about how significant you see this, that people weren't willing to publicly talk about this.
I think that there are two issues at play. The first issue that I see is what I would call a violation of expectations. That most of us, when we grew up, we understood, we heard, it was in our culture, even if it was never spoken about, that the man earns more money than the woman. And so now we're entering into marriages where that is not necessarily true, where it might be the woman who earns more, they might earn equally, or the woman might be the only wage earner for the family. And anytime there's a violation of expectations, it can lead to conflict. It is a risk factor for a marriage. So that's number one. The second thing is a lack of communication about it. So if people are lying to outsiders, what are they talking about amongst themselves? Are they talking about the lie? Is the lie just understood between them? Do they even talk about to each other the fact that they are lying? So I think it's a two issues, two-pronged: violation of expectations, which is a risk factor, and lack of communication about the issues, which is also a risk factor for a healthy marriage.
Can I ask you about the violation of expectations? Because obviously this is, as we've been talking about, this trend of women earning more is not going anywhere. So I wonder what advice you have to couples in these scenarios about adjusting expectations. Is this something that you think is generational and will happen as maybe a different thing with younger couples than older couples?
I can only hope so. That would be nice if that expectation changes and it's either neutral or there is no expectation because either one could make more money and either one could be the wage earner, either one could be the stay-at-home parent. So in terms of what to do about this is the second prong, which is I always encourage the couples that I see to talk about the issue. And my research is all about talking about the issues too. So sometimes it's a verbal contract that if I make more money, then you will do more at home. Or it might be hours. If I work longer hours, you'll do more at home. Or it might be more specific than that. It might be whoever gets home first makes the dinner and the other person cleans up. One puts the children to bed and the other finishes the other things that have to be done in the house. So a lot of these, for most of us, a lot of these jobs, a lot of this division of labor isn't talked about. We just take over what we know. And so I would encourage people to talk about it, have a contract, have some ideas, and I think most importantly, negotiate what will work for you, your partner, and your family.
We've been talking to you about this on social media. Kate, by the way, you can tweet us. Our handle is 21STShow. You can give us a call. Our phone number is 1-800-222-9455. Kate on Twitter said, "This might be a generational thing. My friends and I all earn more than our boyfriends, fiancés, husbands. And no one seems to care. Furthermore, we get excited about the prospect of using them as stay-at-home dads in lieu of putting our careers on hold. My boyfriend says that's his dream scenario." That's Kate in Chicago on Twitter. Kelly in Chicago on Facebook wrote, "My husband stays at home with our kids. We both love it overall. There are gripes on both ends, but it's definitely the right arrangement for our family." We'd love to hear from you on this. Again, our phone number is 1-800-222-9455. Tamara, can I just ask you, were saying about it's great to hear Kelly and Kate's stories of things going well. When things don't go well, and particularly when you're talking about difficult subjects, and I think money is always one of those things, I wonder how important you think it is in a relationship, even before marriage, to have conversations about, for example, money.
I think that's the best time to start having these conversations. It's not just about money, but it's about expectations. So what do we want for our family? What do we want for ourselves? How will we negotiate money issues? So is it just based on who makes more money? They have more power in negotiating how that money is spent. Is it a certain amount of money that gets spent, gets negotiated, but everything else doesn't? Is it we're going to have separate bank accounts and we get to decide on our own bank account what money gets spent and how it gets spent, etc.? So I agree with you. I think the best time is before marriage.
And if you haven't done that?
There's no expiration date on it. Do it now. Talk about what your hopes are, what your dreams are, what the culture is, how it'll work together. And with also the idea that all of us who've been married a long time understand that what we want and the reality may not match. So I may want to stay home and my husband may want to work and then I'm making more money and he loses his job or I lose my job. Or it's easier for him to step out of the workplace than it is for me to step out of the workplace.
Because things also change.
Things change. Sometimes they change in a planned way, like when you have kids or when the kids leave the home. And sometimes they change, oftentimes they change in a very unplanned way. So just because you've had the conversation once, it's not the end of it. It is just the building block to continue that conversation across time.
And Andy, to add on to that, what other solutions or advice do you offer to women who are the highest earners in their household?
I think that, besides the fact that marriage is a partnership and that's not always easy, but I think that people need to realize that things can change all the time. And so if you're thinking about basic financial planning, that means such things as making sure that there's enough life insurance on both parents to cover lost income, or to cover the costs of childcare. So if the wife is making more money she dies, then there needs to make sure that that income is replaced. But that goes for the parent who stays at home, because if that parent dies, there's suddenly an increased cost just of childcare, just this basic, not even getting into a lot of the other things that would happen to the family in those circumstances. I think that the family needs to think about how they're going to manage money for the long term, because again, sometimes these things are situational. You know, somebody makes more money, then they lose their job, or someone is making less money, then they reenter the workforce and, you know, start making more money again. I think that there can also be some interesting dynamics in retirement, because retirement income may not be equal. Usually the man's retirement income is greater, but for women, some traditionally female jobs like teaching and nursing may have lower salaries but very high pensions. And so in retirement, that dynamic can shift where the woman's retirement income is greater than the man's retirement
and
income.
And I did want to ask you about that, Annie, about retirement, how that figures into the conversation, especially if there are different earnings. How do you have a conversation about planning for retirement?
There's a couple of factors, and one is what people are bringing to retirement in terms of their benefits from their different jobs and their different savings. A second is how they plan to spend their money in retirement. And a third is the timing, because women generally, although they may have a higher income from year to year, over a lifetime, a woman's income is almost always lower on average. And one of the reasons for that is that, again, this women tend to marry up, men tend to marry down. That goes for age. So women tend to marry men who are a few years older, so they're going to retire a few years earlier. And it's often very difficult in a marriage for the man to be staying at home retired and the woman to still be working. So a lot of women will then retire before their full retirement age, and that can curtail the amount of income they have for the rest of their lives. And women do tend to live longer. So not only do they tend to marry older men who are going to die younger or who will die sooner, but men tend to die at earlier ages. So thinking about how you're going to manage that income, given that retirement savings for very different lifespans, is a very important conversation to have, and may affect the retirement date for both partners.
That's a good point. The man who's
dying to quit his job at 62 could be having a huge effect on his wife's her income.
Tamara Goldman-Schur, I just wanted to ask you one last question as we're thinking about this issue, and you've been able to give us some tips on how to frame these conversations. Money is something that some people find just really hard to talk about. So how do you suggest someone approach the conversation if it's not something they're good at doing or have experience doing?
Well, I think that they need to keep in mind when they want to have this conversation. So I would never suggest a conversation like this if somebody is tired or somebody is hungry or somebody is rushed. So probably not when someone's just rushing out the door in the morning or someone's rushing back in later at night. I think put it on an agenda. So I want to have this conversation with you. Can we talk about it this weekend? Even can we talk about it Sunday night? And set a stage for it, turn off the screens and look at each other and ask the other person what's on their mind as well as what's on your mind, which will be facilitated if you've put it on an agenda so that both people can talk about it and nobody is surprised.
That's Tamara Goldman-Schur. She's practices clinical psychology at the Family Institute at Northwestern University. I want to thank her and UIC's Annie Logue, who's also the author of a number of books in the Four Dummies series about finance and investing. Ladies, thanks for being with me. I appreciate it.
Thanks for having me.
You're welcome. Thank you.
Thanks for tuning in to The 21st. I'm Nyla Boodoo.
Workers are back on the job, and we are once again pouring new American steel into the spine of our country.
That's President Donald Trump last Thursday at the United States Steelworks in Granite City, where he visited Illinois for the first time since taking office. Donald Trump's name won't be on the ballot this fall, but whether or not voters like what he's done in office could determine whether Democrats or Republicans will win their elections, whether it's for Congress, for governor, or for other state or local offices. So when President Trump spoke at a local steel mill in Granite City, where some 500 workers have been brought back on the job because of his administration's tariffs on foreign steel, hundreds more expected to be hired, we wanted to talk today about the political implications of that for local politicians. And to do that, we've asked Joe Bustos to come back. He was there at the steel mill covering the president's visit for the Belleville News Democrat, where he's a reporter. He's on the line. Hey, Joe, welcome back to the 21st.
Thanks for having me.
Mark Maxwell is also with us from Springfield, where he's Capital Bureau Chief at WCIA3. Good morning, Mark. Thanks for being with us as well.
Hi, Nyla. Good morning.
Good morning. Joe, before we get to how this affects state politics and who chose to be with the president and who did not show up, I wanted to just go back to the actual visit. I wonder if you can set the scene for us what it was like with the president at the steel mill in Granite City.
Well, inside the warehouse where the event was held, it was a very friendly crowd. The president remarked that they never sat down when he took the stage. I mean, the entire crowd was standing and cheering as he spoke about the tariffs that he put into place and helped, which they say help bring back those 500 and expected to be 800 jobs by October to the steel mill in a town of about 28,000 people. So it was a very, very happy crowd outside. There was supporters along the motorcade route waving signs, thank you for making Granite City great again. But whenever a president shows up, you get some protesters. They did keep their, for the most part, they kept their distance away from the supporters. So whenever a president comes down, you get a little bit of a carnival atmosphere, a festival atmosphere out there.
And that's what it was like.
Yeah.
And so let's talk about who was there. Republican Congressman Mike Bost and Rodney Davis were both there, both of them facing some tough reelection campaigns this fall that we're going to talk about in a minute. Joe, did the president mention them?
Yeah, he actually mentioned Congressman Bost and Congressman Davis, as well as Congressman Shimkus, saying they work very hard for the area. And later on, he even said you have to vote Republican, even though this wasn't an official event, not supposed to be political. He did give his little plug for Congressman Bost and Congressman Davis ahead of the election, and that usually will probably help in at least getting their base energized.
And I know that in other public appearances, the president has, and this has been, was a big story this weekend as well, singling out the news media, calling them liars and enemies of the people. Did that happen this time?
Yeah, we got, he made a point that there were, look at all these cameras here. They never really followed Obama or President Bush around, and even though anytime a president shows up, there's lots of cameras around. And he did make the comments of the fake news, and they're going to dissect every word he says, looking for one little mistake that he might make. So it's par for the course for him. It was one of those things that you kind of waited for, and then once it happened, like, okay, cool, we got that out of the way. And
what was the response? I wonder, what was the response of the crowd, and how did you feel?
There was a little bit of I think one of the media, one of the press people pointed out there was some boos out there, but I think there was a little bit of laughter about that as well from the crowd. I don't know if it was a laughter in support of the media, but there was a definite reaction to that.
We're talking with the Belleville News' Democrat, Joe Bustos, who was at the steel mill, United States Steel Mill in Granite City last Thursday when President Trump visited. Mark, I wonder if we can get to the state politics of this, starting with our Republican Governor Bruce Rauner. Did he say why did he say he wasn't in Granite City to be with the president?
Well, the governor made several stops on that day. I believe there were three or four different stops throughout the Peoria Rockford region. And Governor Rauner really only said, look, we have a busy day. We had things that were pre-planned, and didn't say much about what was going on at all. In fact, at a stop in Bloomington, I believe, or in Peoria, rather, reporters directly asked him on camera, why aren't you at the event to support the president? And he just kind of just ignored the question and said, well, we have something going on here. In Rockford, closer to Chicago, in fact, there was a different event earlier in the morning where some Chicago press followed him around a hallway, up a staircase, and a whole crew of cameras was following the governor trying to get that very answer from him. And all the cameras got was the back of him as he walked away into his government vehicle. And he just refused to answer the question. So as the president continues to ramp up his public campaigning, it's possible he comes back through Illinois at some point. The president has said he wants to openly campaign these last 100 days until the election to help House Republicans win in Congress. And you see Governor Rauner's reluctance, if not downright refusal, to openly engage this president's personality. And he'll talk about some of the issues, but he completely stays away from the more electric and mercurial sides of President Donald Trump.
And how unusual is it for a sitting governor not to meet with a president from their own party when they visit the state, Mark?
Well, certainly in modern history, I don't think we've seen anything like this. We saw just 2 weeks prior, Governor Rauner embraced the vice president, Mike Pence, who by most accounts is someone more palatable to the mainstream conservative party, or at least the pre-Trump era, right? Back when Republicans certainly didn't have a firebrand at the front of their party. But it's really unprecedented, I think. It's certainly unusual, the word you used. And it just shows that this governor, who fancies himself a moderate, someone who will compromise, someone who stands sort of with one foot in both parties, and signed some bills that have been socially liberal, but prefers a more fiscal conservative side. He just really doesn't want to get pulled into the polarizing political landscape that President Trump has created with his splash on the scene in 2016.
And a governor who has, I believe it's the third highest rate of disapproval among American voters of governors, according to the most recent polls that came out. I think it was last week. Joe, I wonder if we can talk about the politics of the area where President Trump was visiting. You mentioned Congressman Bost, that's Illinois' 12th congressional district. But the Steelworkers Union is actually endorsing his Democratic opponent, Brendan Kelly. And I wanted to play some of an interview with the union's president, Dan Simmons, about why they're not endorsing Mike Bost or Democrats in the fall.
We met with all of these, Congressman Bost included, and said, you're either with us or you're against us. You know, 50% of the time is not good enough. You know, 20% of the time is not good enough. And in his case, it's in that lower 20% range. So that's not good enough.
That's the president of the local steelworkers union in Granite City, Dan Simmons. It's Local 1899. Joe, can you help us understand what we just heard there? He said that Congressman Bost was in the lower 20% range as far as supporting the steelworkers union is concerned. And I imagine he feels similarly about Governor Rauner, since they're not, since they're also endorsing his Democratic opponent, J.B. Pritzker. What is he referring to when he says not good enough?
I think recently one of the local unions, I think it was AFL-CIO, said Bost like had an F rating in terms of voting with the union, at least a voting record when it comes to union issues. Even though Congressman Bost he's someone who was against right to work. He said he was disappointed with the Janus decision that came out of the Supreme Court. Congressman Bost Congressman Bost is a Republican, and some of the unions in this area have been traditionally strong Democratic voters, and so that I think that's where part of that is coming from.
And Joe, you were noting last week that lots of Democrats took the president's trip as an opportunity to do some fundraising. Did Brendan Kelly do the same thing?
Yeah, I think he sent out an email on the day the president was in town saying, hey, President Trump's in town. We need to gain some money to help fight his message. And I think there was something similar when Vice President Pence was in town the week before. So this was something that it's a good opportunity to try to get your base energized. their Democratic base energized, say, hey, look, there's that Republican president. Let's see what we could do to fight that message.
So that's the 12th district. Mark, I want to switch to the 13th district. That covers a big part of our listening area of folks who are listening to the 21st right now. It's a huge district. It's all part of 14 different counties across central and southwestern Illinois. Bloomington, Champaign, Springfield, currently represented by Republican Congressman Rodney Davis, who was with President Trump last week. Mark, how popular was Donald Trump's voting, first of all, in the 13th?
Well, President Trump really outperformed expectations in that region, and he won by more than a majority, and you know, really brought out a lot of counties that before might have been, you know, moderate red. Some would go blue. It's certainly in Madison County, that has traditionally been a more Democratic voting area. But with President Trump again changing the political landscape, it really turned a deeper red color in 2016. But you know, President Trump's not on the ballot in 2018, and now you have voters looking for, okay, who is serving our interest? And in Congress, usually we see, you know, historically some pushback against the president in power. So we have Betsy Dirksen-Lonergan, a Democrat who has been a longtime aide and staffer to Senator Dick Durbin, is challenging the incumbent Republican Rodney Davis. And her most recent challenge ahead of President Trump's visit was, if Congressman Rodney Davis won't look President Trump in the face and tell him that his trade war is hurting our farmers, then, quote, he doesn't deserve to represent the 13th district. And she sort of made that challenge. We saw the Davis campaign push back immediately and say, maybe Betsy isn't aware of all the new jobs that were saved and the steel workers, and maybe she doesn't stand with them. And so you see this very sharp exchange between two candidates running for this 13th district seat, and they really have no qualms about fighting tooth and nail over the impact President Trump has had. Another area they're fighting over is this issue of the tax cuts. Congressman Rodney Davis is proudly touting their impact. Betsy Dirksen-Lonergan calls them a tax scam and says they're not for us, the little people. They were for the rich and wealthy corporations. So this is an interesting fight. And this one, perhaps more than most, really does revolve around President Trump and whether or not the voters of the 13th feel he's been a success so far.
Mark, the Cook Political Report, that's out of Washington, and they do forecasts for congressional races. They just changed their forecast from the 13th district from likely Republican to lean Republican, a sign that the race is tightening. Would you say that this is the most competitive the 13th district has been in a while?
Well, the Dirksen-Lonergan campaign certainly feels that way. And by the way, they don't feel that Cook Political Report moved for the last time. There's still a few months to go here, and they're up
99 days, if we're correct, right? Today is 99 days until the midterm.
Yeah, but who's counting, right? I mean, we've all got our wall calendars and looking forward to November 6th. But,
probably, yeah, just the journalists and politicians, but yes.
I suppose that's true. Most other people are waiting. They're counting down the days until the campaign commercials stop bombarding them. But the Dirksen-Lonergan campaign felt more than a little bit of oxygen hit their you know, the wind in their sails, so to speak, after that Cook Political Report analysis came down. And they think that the closer they get to this race, especially if the presidency goes into some other tailspin that becomes a weight around the Davis campaign's neck, if there's anything like that, they feel like the closer we get to November, the better their chances will improve. That Davis campaign has pretty much said, we're going to ride in the sidecar with President Trump and try to last this thing out.
We will see how this all plays out. Mark Maxwell from WCIA3, where he's Capitol Bureau Chief in Springfield, will be following that, along with Joe Bustos with the Belleville News Democrat. Of course, we will be too here on the 21st. Joe, Mark, thanks for being with me. I appreciate it.
Thanks for having me.
That does it for us today. On tomorrow's program, we're going to be talking about the hundreds of immigrant children that are being housed in shelters in Illinois. There's new information that's revealed allegations of abuse and threats specifically at those Illinois shelters. We're going to be talking to ProPublica Illinois about that tomorrow. We're also going to talk about ways to take a break and enjoy the outdoors without your phone. So stay tuned to the 21st for that tomorrow. You can always head to our website, 21stshow.org, to give us feedback. If you want to find out how to leave us a voicemail, send us an email, or follow us as social media. We are a production of Illinois Public Media. Thanks for tuning in today. I'm Nyla Boodoo. Have a good day. See you back here tomorrow.